So welcome everyone to our next installment of the JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The theme for today is going to be not the Robert Louis Stevenson novel, nor the musical that they made, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But if you've ever noticed, you may not have noticed, this eluded me for a long time. But why do they call him Mr. Hyde? Because he's hiding within Jekyll. In other words, there are elements of Dr. Jekyll's soul that are dark. And that darkness with the medicine that he takes trying to save his father, at least that's the narrative I heard, that Dr. Jekyll's medicine that he takes transforms him and allows the dark side, the Mr. Hyde side that's hiding dormant within him, to be released. Jacob and Esau are fraternal twins. So my understanding of fraternal twins is that there are two eggs and either one or two sperm that initiate the eggs and cause that, and that they share a womb. Now, clearly, they're not identical twins. They don't share everything physiologically. I believe, again, there's lots of papers written about it. I did a little bit of research, that most fraternal twins have a connection because they share more than your normal sibling would share. But physiologically, biologically, you only share the same sort of genetics as you would with any other sibling. Just so happens you share a womb. And that has a lot of connection power. So clearly, if Jacob and Esau, if Yaakov and Esau share a womb, and Rebekah is told by Hashem through Malki Tzedek, who is a man who had prophetic powers, that Shnei Goyim Mimayichi Paredu, that you're going to have these two great nations that are lurking within your womb and your confines of your body, and then they're going to emerge and be divided. One will go one way, one will go the other. Clearly, there's a lot of genetics. But thematically then, what we're going to try to discuss is the following. Here's the question at hand. Ready? We're going to try to answer this. A blessing, a bracha, in the Torah, is not a generic blessing. Now, today, they could be generic, because we take a blessing, and you can make it generic that will fit everyone. You know, like we say, for example, the Birkat Kohanim, the blessing of the Kohanim, Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmerecha, God should bless you and watch out over for you. Okay? And we bless our children with that blessing. But clearly, the original version of that blessing by Jacob's grandchildren, when it emerges for the first time, is nuanced for the uniqueness of Ephraim and Manasseh. More to the point, when the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 sons of Jacob, come before him in Parshat Vayechi, at the end of Jacob's life as he's about to depart this world, he gives each son a unique blessing. Now think about it for a moment. What if Jacob accidentally gave Judah's blessing to, I don't know, Yisachar? Or Naphtali's blessing he gave accidentally to God? Would it even have an effect? In other words, it's not simply a blessing. It's so specific. It's so nuanced that a blessing can only work if the intended audience is the recipient. We hear that? All right, so now here's the question. Isaac is blind. Isaac believes that the son before him getting his blessing is Esau. Is Esau. Yeah? Because it's Jacob dressed up with the goat skins and he's pretending on some level to be his big brother Esau. Well, if that's true, that Isaac believes and doesn't even figure out the whole ruse until retroactively after the fact, Esau comes in for his blessing and loses his mind when he realizes what Jacob did, the subterfuge. How could the blessing that Isaac gave Jacob have any impact, have any effect on Jacob? It was Esau's blessing. So how would that work? So we're going to try to answer that today through Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Okay, so file that question away. It's a wonderful question, I think. And we'll get back to that question a little later on this morning. Okay? Let's look at source one. And it was, and this is from our Parsha this week, Parshat Vayetze. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, brother of his mother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob stepped forward and rolled the stone from upon the mouth of the well and watered the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. Did you notice it says mother's brother how many times? Three times in one sentence. Isn't that weird? Strange. Then Jacob kissed Rachel, and he raised his voice, and he wept. Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother. Well, that's not true. He's the nephew. All right. He told Rachel that he was her father's brother, and that he was Rebekah's son. Then she, Rachel, ran and told her father, Laban. Okay, so here's a little backstory. At the end of this last parsha, Toldot, two things are in play. Esau has tremendous animosity, ill will, towards his brother Jacob for the subterfuge that Jacob took his blessing. And he has publicly married a bunch of Canaanite women, and that's all that's on the market there in Canaan. They're just Canaanite choice ladies. But there are Abraham and Sarah family ladies waiting to be married, but you have to go away from Israel back to Haran, back to that place where Abraham and Sarah first sort of stopped on their journey. Rabbis aren't 100% sure where that location might be. It might be somewhere in like Syria, Turkey area, probably someplace right now that there's a war going on, okay? So it's in that area, Padan Aram, Ir Nahor, and how did that family get there? Because you see, Abraham was one of three brothers. It was Abraham and his brother Haran, and then he had a brother named Nahor. We don't really know that much about, other than that Nahor had a bunch of kids and grandchildren, and we do know a lot about. So his brother Haran died prematurely. Haran had two children. This is Abraham's brother. This is going to bend your mind a little bit. One of Haran's children, you know all about him. His name was Lot. He's the one who left Abraham. He couldn't handle Abraham's kindness. Went to Sodom and Gomorrah. Was rescued by the angels. Mrs. Lot, you know what happened to her when she looked behind. Lot never does go back to Abraham in this world. He just stays away from Abraham. So that's his brother Haran. But Haran also had a daughter. Just trivia question. Anyone know who the daughter of Haran was? You do know her. Sarah. Thank you. Sarah was the niece of Abraham, only 10 years younger. They weren't that far apart chronologically. But he marries Haran's daughter, Sarah. Now, but what about Nahor? Well, Nahor had some children. One of them was a man named Betuel. Really evil, evil man. And Betuel, who used to defile young girls, they had like this, I can't remember what it's called, but there's a rite, it's a horrific thing that was enacted by the British during when they subjugated the Scottish during the wars. When a young virginal girl gets married, the lord of the area gets to spend the first night with the girl. There's a name for it. I don't remember the name, probably because it's a horrible idea, but there is some official name. And I remember there was a movie called Braveheart, and I think that was one of the key components, that when the William Wallace character, who gets freedom, you know, for the Scots from the King of England, when he gets married secretly so that the local whoever won't have to sleep with his wife before he does, right? So Betuel had that rule in his city. So he's a really horrific, horrific guy. His name Betuel, by the way, comes from virgin. Betula is a young girl who's a virgin. So that's where his name, even the Torah is like saying, this is a really evil man. So Betuel has children. Laban, his son, and Rebecca, our great-grandmother, comes from this nefarious clan. All right, now, Laban has daughters, a whole bunch of them, and you know them all. Rachel and Leah and Zilpah and Bilhah. Now, Rachel and Leah were full sisters. Zilpah and Bilhah, who were the maidservants, they were sort of like half-sisters. They shared the father, but they clearly did not share the mother aspect. So, interesting. I'm giving you a little background that you need to know. All right. So, Jacob, at the behest of mom and dad, mainly mom, who basically says to Isaac, I cannot bear that our son Jacob marries one of these vicious Canaanite girls. It can't be. So please send him away. He's got to get someone from my family, Rebecca says. Now that comes at a tremendous cost to poor Jacob's morality, as we're going to see. So what happens? He gets his blessing of Abraham, and Isaac bids him farewell. He gives him lots of money for a dowry. Because you remember when Eliezer showed up with the 10 camels, the 10 camels were carrying a whole bunch of good stuff to give as presents to the family of Rebekah. So can you imagine when Laban hears that Jacob has shown up to get another wife, he has delusions of grandeur. He probably thinks that poor nephew Jacob has come with a lot of money. And he's very disappointed because what happens? On his way there, Esau sends his son Eliphaz to murder Jacob for having stolen his blessing. So he can't do it himself. So he tells his son, poor Eliphaz, go murder your uncle. Now Eliphaz is scared of his dad, so he doesn't want to like disobey dad. So he tracks down Jacob, and instead of murdering Jacob, he takes all of his money. And then Jacob says, look, a man who has literally nothing, you can say he's dead for all intents and purposes. Maybe not literally, but metaphorically. So go tell dear old dad that Jacob, his brother, is now dead. So Eliphaz didn't really want to murder his uncle because he had been sort of nurtured and taught Torah by his Zaidi, his grandfather, Isaac. So he had like this pull within him not to commit this horrific crime of murdering and killing Jacob, his uncle. So Eliphaz takes all his money. But that means that when Jacob shows up at the well to get a wife, he has nothing to offer, right? Okay, so he shows up at the well, as we saw. And when he sees Rachel, he cries because he sees somehow in his vision that Rachel and he are not destined to be buried next to each other. If you recall, Rachel dies on the road home from Laban's house while giving birth to Benjamin, and she is not buried in the cave that Abraham bought. She's buried on the road. Any of you who have visited Israel went to Kever Rachel, to the burial place of Rachel, it's just outside of Jerusalem, right? It's like literally a stone's throw from Jerusalem. It is not in Hebron at all. But that was by God's design, that Rachel should be buried there and not with the rest of the matriarchs and patriarchs. Okay. So why does Jacob say to Rachel that I am your father's brother and also that he was Rebekah's son? Why the family identifier? So have a look at Rashi, source number 2. That he was her father's brother. So the simple explanation, the pashup shot is, he's a relative of her father. Like, we are men who are brothers. Yeah. So people culturally say, hey, bro. Hey, brother, how are you? So that doesn't mean you're a blood brother. It means you're, you know, either family or you consider yourself emotionally, figuratively, as a mishpacha, as a family. Okay, that's the simple explanation. But that doesn't really answer the question because it doesn't really wash. So have a look at the Midrashic interpretation. This is the oral tradition. So this is, again, in source number 2. If Laban comes for deceit, I too am his brother in deceit. But if he, your dad, Laban, is a decent person, I am also the son of Rebekah, his decent sister. So he was telling Rachel, hey, I'm armed and prepared for dear old dad. Because dear old dad, Laban, is the most formidable sorcerer and practitioner of the dark forces that there was to be found in the world. He was so nefarious that Esau would never think of coming to Laban's house to try to murder Jacob there. Even Esau, as bad as he was, he would say, no, I'm not going near Lavan. He's a little scary. So Lavan's sort of like the Emperor Palpatine, you know, from the Star Wars. He's the evil emperor. You don't mess with him. So even Esau wouldn't mess with him. But poor Jacob has to get a daughter or two or three or four and spend, 20 years in the relative proximity of this nefarious character. Like poor Jacob. I mean, what's going on? So here's the question. Jacob is defined by a couple of different character traits. Yeah? Each of the avot, we've spoken about this. Each of the forefathers, right, the patriarchs, are defined by a character trait. We said that Abraham is Mr. Chesed, his kindness. Isaac is Gevura, Din, judgment. And Jacob is either Tiferet, which is a unique character trait that we don't have to talk about today, or he's also Emet. We actually say, Yaakov Emet, Udvarcha Emet. Jacob is truth. God gave truth to Jacob, we say in the prayers. Well, let me ask you a question. Is this a truthful statement? I am Lavan, your dear old dad's brother in deceit. In other words, he's saying, he's boasting, or at least assuring Rachel that, hey, I got this one. I got it under control. If your father comes in deceit, I am his brother in deceit. You're his brother in deceit? What? Look at source 3. This is a ridiculous statement. The lads, the youths, grew up, it says, in Genesis 25. This is last week's story reading. And Esau became a man who knows hunting, a man of the field. But Jacob was a wholesome man, dwelling in tents. All right, so have a look at number 4. What does it mean Esau was a man who knows hunting? Why doesn't it just say he was a hunter? What do you mean, either you're a hunter or you're not a hunter? What do you mean you know hunting? Is that a weird vernacular? So Rashi is bothered by that. So he says, well, it means two things. He was a great hunter, yeah. But there was a second type of hunting that he perpetrated to ensnare and to deceive his father Isaac with his mouth. Okay, so in other words, you don't have to go beyond that. So that Esau was a hunter of animals, yes. But he also was a hunter of humans, manipulation, subterfuge. That was Esau. But what does it mean, number 5, that Jacob was the wholesome man, Ishtam, Yoshev Ohalim, dwelling in tents? He is not an expert in all these things that Esau is expert in. But as is his heart, so is his mouth. One who is not sharp in deceiving is called wholesome. Wow. So this is the definition of poor Jacob, right? Jacob, as a youth, is the Ishtam, the son who is pure and wholesome, a goody two-shoes, and very honest, Mr. Emet. So then how do we meet Jacob, and how do we reconcile his outrageous statement to his future bride, Rachel, when he says that if your dad comes for deceit, I'm his brother in deceit. I'll take him to the cleaners. You'll take Lavan to the cleaners? What? Now, do you remember there used to be in New York those perpetually going out of business stores? You know, there were the electronic stores. Mm-hmm. And you could go back year after year, and they would still be going out of business, right? So I remember as a yeshiva bacher, maybe I was a little bit like Jacob, wet behind the ears. I wanted, which at the time was the hottest technological advancement in the world. Do you remember the Sony Walkman? They were. Do you remember? They were the cat's meow, right? They were the most desired gift in the world. So for yeshiva, I was allowed to have my own personal Walkman. So they had two. They had an Iowa, which was a brand that was also made by Sony, and then they had the famous real Sony. So I'll never forget my first trip to New York. I made the mistake of going into one of these perpetually going out of business places, and he showed me a Sony, but it wasn't a Sony. It had an extra letter. So I looked at the box. I said, but wait a minute, sir. I said, this is not a Sony. It's like a Sonyo. He said, oh, he said, with his Middle Eastern accent. He says, oh, he says, Sony, Sonyo, the same factory, trust me. And I looked at the price, and I knew, because I had a little bit of knowledge in this area, that the MSRP, the manufacturer suggested retail price on a Sony Walkman was like $299. So on his box of the Sonyeon, so it wasn't a Sony, it was something, whatever, we don't know what it was. We don't even know if anything was in the box that was operable. I never did buy it, I promise you. So on the I'll never forget this, they had sticker shock, right? They had 999 crossed out. And then it had 699 crossed out. And then it had $399 as the price. And I knew the actual price was at least $100 less than that, that I could walk into Macy's or Bloomingdale's and get it for $299. Why do I need to go to Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe, you know, to buy his Sonyeon? So that is like the Lavin, because he was good. He almost sold me on it, you know, like he was a master of the, you know, so Lavin would make Ephron the Hittite embarrassed, because Lavin is like, you know, you take your worst image of a used car salesman from 50 years ago and multiply that 100-fold, then you get a little bit of a sense of Lavin. But Lavin wasn't just into chicanery, because that's really a ganav. That's a thief. But there's a much more subtle version of a thief. And you know, you've heard the name, a con man. Now, the word con is short for confidence. And the reason it is so difficult to deal with somebody like that is you're not even aware that you're dealing with someone like that. In other words, it's not an overt, I'm in your face, I have the power because I have the car, and I could just keep going back and playing with the numbers anytime you want. Well, that's sort of like a little bit of a ganav, right? Yeah, it's like, you know that the guy's a thief. But when the person is a confidence man, it's exactly what it says. They gain your confidence through a relationship. And then by the time you leave a really good confidence man, you won't even know that you've been burned until a day, a week, a year later. And then all of a sudden you say, well, wait a minute, where is that Bernie Madoff character today? You know, he sold me this 85%, you know, interest on this investment. I'm not really seeing those checks yet. And they try to call out Mr. Madoff, and he's made off. By the way, you can't make up a better name. He is made off with your fortune. So with a confidence, you know, with like a Ponzi scheme, whatever, you always want to be the last person in the Ponzi scheme. Right? Because if you're the first person, you'll never get, I mean, the first person, because you'll get your money originally, but if you're last, you never get your money. So you always want to be in on the ground floor of a Ponzi scheme, unfortunately. So that's a situation where you have I'm sure he was a formidable schmoozer, a very impressive man. He probably dressed beautifully. And unfortunately, he conned the world out of a lot of money. That was kind of like Lavin, but even beyond. So how does Jacob, who we have described as the Ishtam Yosho Havailim, he is most decidedly not an expert in anything that his big brother Esau would be. In other words, if Esau would say to Rachel, hey, I'm the match for your brother, you'd say, oh, okay, you know, Ulai, maybe he would be Esau. But Jacob? And yet, Jacob, we know, doesn't lie. So how is this possible? So let's get back to our original question, shall we? See if you remember the original question. The original question is that blessings are specific. They're nuanced. The blessing of Isaac to Jacob, since it was subtly and not so subtly nuanced for the unique character traits and potentiality of Esau, and it went instead to Jacob, how could it even help Jacob? In other words, it's sort of like you have two brothers, right? Do you remember there was a movie called Twins? Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, right? It was a silly movie, but cute. Okay, so that's a great analogy. So suppose Dad gave DeVito by mistake. So let's say DeVito somehow pulled off a ruse, and he gets the Schwarzenegger blessing. May you be Mr. Universe 10 times. May your muscles grow bigger than Sylvester Stallone. You know, this type of blessing. That's not going to help little Danny DeVito, right? Or if Schwarzenegger gets the blessing, may you be, you know, the funniest guy and on a show called Taxi and have, you know, like be a great comedian and, you know, be short but brilliant. That's not going to help Schwarzenegger. So again, how does Jacob even benefit from the blessing that he got from dear old Dad? There's only one way. I don't know if you caught it, but we're moving in that direction. You ready? The only possibility is that Jacob becomes Mr. Hyde. He has to assume the mantle of Esau. Oh, well, once he's Esau, somehow we're going to have to figure out how that happened and where it happened. But if he is Esau, then that blessing that he got from Isaac becomes his blessing, because he now has sort of subsumed those unique character traits that were once Esau's only, but now Jacob possesses them also. Now, there's a hint to this. Laban had two daughters. The oldest was named Leah, our dear mother Leah, and the other younger was Rachel. Jacob ends up marrying both of them, correct? When they were born, it was announced officially, a shidduch, a marriage was made. And everyone in the world apparently knew, including poor Leah, oh, she was the oldest. She was destined to marry the oldest of Rebekah and Isaac's two kids. She was going to marry Esau. And the youngest, Jacob, was destined to marry Rachel. And Leah was distraught beyond words. Every single day, she cried. She cried so much that her eyes waxed dim from her crying. She was a beautiful woman, but the copious amount of tears hurt her physically and emotionally. She prayed to God every day, please don't let me marry this wicked man Esau, because his evil, nefarious reputation had spread. Everyone knew. It was a busha. It was embarrassing. And of course, God listened to Leah and allowed Leah to marry Jacob. So if it wasn't self-evident, Jacob marries the intended a big brother Esau, right? That should be a very big proof that somehow Jacob is able to incorporate the components of Esau in himself that allowed him to have a successful union and marriage, not only with Rachel, his predestined one, but with his brother's mate, Leah. So that's kind of a neat thing, right? But more than that, did you ever notice something unusual about Jacob? He is the only forefather that has two names. Now you might say, but Abraham was Avram. No, no. Avram and Avraham, Sarai and Sarah, it's the same name, just a little change in status as they are elevated. Jacob, though, becomes Israel. At what point does Jacob become Israel? Do you remember? Hasn't happened yet in the Torah reading this year, but we have read it in the past. He does it after wrestling with the protector angel of who? Of Esau. And defeating Esau's angel in the all-night WrestleMania. Yeah? At that point, Esau's angel is forced to give him a new name, Israel. Could it be that at that point, officially, Jacob as Israel has a second name? And the rabbis in the Midrash actually say it's an amazing idea that Jacob has two names. You know why? Because originally there were going to be four fathers and four mothers. You know who that fourth forefather was going to be? Esau. But since Esau relinquished it through his evil, it was up to Jacob to step up and become two forefathers. So he becomes both Jacob, the one who's married to Rachel, and he becomes Israel, the one who's married to Leah. How's that one? Wow. So you see, in a very real way, Jacob has to, by design, step up and incorporate those Esau elements into himself. And think about the new Jacob that arrives at the well. Okay, let's think about it for a moment. So he gets to the well, and the first interaction he has, it's not here, is with the shepherds. Now, shepherds back then, I don't know about shepherds today. Does anyone know a shepherd today? No. Okay. Are there shepherds today? I don't know. There are border collies running around, very cute, very smart dogs. But I'm not sure about any shepherds, right? So shepherds back then were considered a very, shall we say, less than desirable occupation, right? They were like very low in terms of morality, in terms of language, in terms of the propensity for violence was there. So they were not the type of people that you made sport of. So here's Jacob. He arrives at the well, and what are the shepherds doing? They're all lazing around because apparently nobody trusted anyone there, and they put a gigantic stone on the well, on the water supply, which would ensure that multiple people would be necessary to be present to roll the stone off to get the water. No one else could, in subterfuge, come by and just steal all the water. So what does he do? When he sees them lazing around, he's worried that they're on the clock and they're stealing money from the boss. So he says to the guys, he rebukes them. What? The day's not over. How come you guys are lazing around? He rebukes the shepherds? Like I'm sorry, but that's like waking up the Rottweiler, pushing the Rottweiler is sleeping there, and you start poking the dog. Hey, are you really a dangerous dog? And then he wakes up and he looks at you and says, yeah, time for lunch. You'll see. Like, you don't poke the shepherds. And he does. There's a lot of bravado, but it's better than that. He sees Rachel, the beautiful girl, come to the well. What does he do? Gemara says he walks over to the well and he takes a little spinach and he gets his superpowers, his Popeye powers, and he just pops that stone like a cork on a champagne bottle. Bravado. This is Jacob? And then what does he do that really comes back to hurt him? He kisses the girl. He gives Rachel a kiss in front of the public. Now, how does it bite him a little bit? Because later on, when the subterfuge happens, it's dark and they get married at night. His father-in-law-to-be, Lavan, says, hey, are you worried about having this at night? We're sensitive to decorum here. Well, you wouldn't know that because what morality do you have kissing girls in public like that? So who are you to judge how we behave here? So again, the act of sort of the imminent violence from the shepherds and Jacob just sort of rebuking them nevertheless, showing this bravado in front of the girl and then kissing the girl, does this sound like Jacob? Or does it more sound like Esau, right? And then he makes the statement, hey, I'm your father's brother in deceit. But what if it's true? Here's the short answer. It is true. Well, how is that possible? Okay. Have a look at source number 6. He, Jacob, this is the beginning of the Parsha this week, right? He, Jacob, encountered the place, Mount Moriah, future site of the temple of the Beit HaMikdash in Jerusalem, and spent the night there because the sun had set. God set the sun prematurely to ensure that he wouldn't leave. He, Jacob, took from the stones of the place, and he put them around his head, and lay down in that place. He also, by the way, davened Marav. He created the evening prayer at that point. Interesting. He had an art scroll sitter there. Okay, number 7. And he lay down in that place. This expresses exclusion. In that place, Jacob lay down. But during the 14 years that he served in the house of Eber, he did not lay down at night because he was occupied with the study of Torah. Now, what are we talking about here? Where's that Rashi? Ah, so there are 14 years that are missing from the life of Jacob. And the rabbis go through a whole arithmetic because they know how old he is. And they know how old he was when he left home. And they say, well, you know what? There's obviously a missing 14 years. Where did he spend those 14 years? So there was a yeshiva, a house of learning, very strange place, as we'll talk about in a minute. It's called the yeshiva, the house of learning, of Shem and Aver. Now, who were Shem and Aver? Well, you know them, right? Shem was the son of Noah. Wow. He also became known in the Torah later as Malki Tzedek. Same guy. Shem, Mr. Renown. And Aver was his grandson of Shem. And he lived later on in the time of the Babylonian project, Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babylon. They became, I guess, the Rosh Yeshivas. They became the heads of this yeshiva. And they learned Torah in Shem and Aver. So everyone always asks, well, what is going on here? Like, what is it? Is it a schoolhouse with like Gemaras on the wall? There was no Talmud back then. There was nothing. There wasn't even a Torah back then. So what are we talking about exactly, right? So it's sort of like Plato University, right? In the time of Plato, the great Greek philosophers, they didn't have like a schoolhouse. There was no physical place. What was Plato U? you had these great people walk around and they would talk philosophy, right? They would walk with their robes and stuff and they would philosophize about life. And that became sort of known as Plato University. So that's kind of a little bit like Yeshiva Shemin Aver. The Yeshiva Shemin Aver had these two amazing men and maybe others, but not a lot of students. And Jacob apparently stayed there and learned from them for a really long time, 14 years. But wait a minute. Why did he need to go there? Why didn't he just go directly to Laban, to Laban's house to get his wife, start his life? Why would he need to go there? Interesting. And he didn't just go there. Apparently, he was such a great student that he just soaked up whatever Torah Shemin Aver had to offer him. Well, wait a minute. Jacob had some pretty good teachers. Well, I will say. Who was his greatest teacher? His dad, Isaac. You know who else he learned Torah from for 15 years? Abraham. Abraham, his Zaidi, taught Jacob as a youth. So for between age 0 and age 15 until Abraham died, Abraham was the Rosh Hashiva. He was the greatest rabbi in the world. So when you have Abraham and Isaac as your teachers, as your rabbis, why do you need these two guys, Shem and Aver, who, I mean, we love them, but they're not even Jews, right? Shem is the son of Noah. He's not Jewish. And Aver, his great-grandson, he's not Jewish either. What Torah, pray tell, was Jacob lacking that he needed to spend 14 years somehow immersed in the Arba Amot, in the proximity of these two men? Like, what would he gain there? So the rabbis say, very simple. You know what Torah he got there? The Torah of survival. Because you see, Jacob was going into exile. Abraham, if you think about it, came from exile to live in the promised land of Israel, right? Isaac never left the promised land of Israel. It was forbidden for him to ever leave. That's why the servant Eliezer had to go get a wife. He was forbidden from leaving the confines of Israel. Jacob, for all intents and purposes, because he becomes Israel, is the first exiled Jew. He is sent by mom and dad into exile to live at Laban's house, and he spends 20 years in exile, only to come home triumphantly with his family. Okay. So this is a concept called Maisa Avos Siman Labanim. The things that happened to the patriarchs and matriarchs and ancestors of the Jewish people are a siman. They're a sign of future events that are still to happen. So the Jewish people are going to go into exile. We lose Temple 1, 70 years until Esther and Mordecai bring us back for Temple 2. Then the Romans get rid of us and we're still in exile. Yeah, I know we have Israel, but we're still formally in Galut. We're living in exile. Now, how do the Jewish people survive thousands of years of Galus, of exile? It's right here. It's because Dr. Jekyll became Mr. Hyde. In other words, there was to be learned in the Yeshiva Shemin Aver a unique survival type of skill that only Shem and only Aver could impart to Jacob and to us. I mean, we have it genetically. Your DNA has this Torah in it. And what's the proof positive? We're sitting here learning this Torah. It's incredible. Mark Twain even talks about how just insanely miraculous. How could the Jews survive? And he recognizes this. Our survival, the fact that we're learning here with coffee, cake, and learning about this, is proof positive that Jacob was successful. He becomes Esav and Jacob. What skills did he acquire? Well, I don't know. I wish I could teach you because they're probably really good. They're like, you know, mysterious Bruce Lee, John Wick, you know, super skills. But I can tell you one thing. Their survival skills came genuinely. Shem was one of only 8 people who survived the flood. So you talk about survival capability. He survived Armageddon. And Aver survived the door, the generation of the dispersion in the time of Babylonia when the tower was destroyed. Aver learned from that survival skills.
So you have these two uniquely gifted individuals, Shem and Aver, who create this little Plato university to impart to Jacob the survival skills he's going to need to win the day against evil Uncle Laban. So in other words, when he announces himself to Rachel, ki achi aviahu, that he is a match for her dear old dad in surreptitious, nefarious activities, he wasn't lying. In other words, he acquires the Esau survival skills from that yeshiva. And what was the moment that it began? You know what the moment began? We know exactly when it began. When he dresses up at the behest of Rebecca. In other words, Rebecca is his first mentor because she comes from Laban. She has those special, unique skills, but instead of using them for the dark side, Rebecca uses them for the good, for the force, for God. So Rebecca says, Jacob, you don't understand. I know you are Mr. Honesty. Now you're going to have to change. And if you don't change, you won't live. You won't survive. Listen to me. Dress up like your brother. I will dress you. I'm the theatrical director. I'll make the whole play work. You go. And he says, but mom, eventually he's going to figure out, either in the moment or after, that it was subterfuge and he's going to curse me rather than bless me. Do you remember Rebecca's response? Powerful. Alai kililascha b'ni. Your curse, should you receive one from Isaac, it'll be on me. I'm your mom. Go listen to what I'm saying. And so at that moment, when he dresses up, he is crying. He's shaking with fear because this is antithetical to who Jacob is. And he goes and he takes the blessing. And now we understand that that blessing eventually does work because he does create and cultivate the unique character traits of Esau the hunter. And he makes them reality through Shem and Aver. And how do we know that he becomes Jacob becomes Esau? Because his dad says it. Listen to the words. Esau, it's on here. They're here. Esau comes in. Dad, rise and bless me. And dad, Isaac starts to shake. Mi'ata b'ni, who are you, my son? I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done what you asked. Here's your food. Eat and bless. And Isaac, charada, he starts to tremble. And he shakes, and he understands now what happened. And he says, ha, ba achicha b'mirma, your brother came already in subterfuge. And he took your blessing. And at that moment, Isaac says the following words, gam baruch yehiyah, he shall so be blessed. Meaning, at that point, Isaac could have cursed out Jacob for having pulled it over on him, but he didn't. He understood this was a necessary evil. All was revealed to Isaac at that point. He now understood who was Esav and who Esav was not and who Jacob could be. And at that moment, he thought to himself, wait a minute. Ba'achicha b'mirma. What? Jacob the goody two-shoes? The wholesome one who lives in tents, Mr. Honesty? He could dress up like you and fake me out? Boom! I know I don't need you, Esav. I always thought I believed erroneously that I needed my two sons to be partners in this world. Esav, guess what, pal? I don't need you anymore. Jacob can be you and him at the same time. I don't need you, Esav. And that, of course, drives Esav to his one moment of absolute regret. And he cries, please, Dad, isn't the blessing's one blessing? Isn't there anything left you can give me? Because Esau finally has regret for what he lost. And of course, it's too late. So when Jacob shows up at the well, Isaac already saw the development that began at the behest of Rebecca, sister of Laban, the Ramai, the con man. And when he shows up, he's been 14 years studying with Shem and Aver, how to survive, how to pull off the con. Now, we're running out of time, but I'll share with you one last thought, okay? So we've talked a lot about what he learned, but I haven't been sort of very clear. I'm not sure I could be any clearer on exactly what skills he attained. That he attained them, for sure he won. Because in the end, what happens? Jacob works for 20 years. Unilaterally, Laban changes his wages hundreds of times. Unilaterally, nice guy. And in the end, who gets all the sheep? Who gets all the animals? Who gets all the girls? Who gets everything? Jacob. So he clearly wins. How does he win? How do you outsmart that guy with the Sanyo perpetually going out of business with that fake Middle Eastern accent? How do you con a con? How can you possibly think ahead of a guy like Laban? And you know what the answer is? I'll leave you with this thought. He actually didn't have to. He simply mirrored the needs of Laban, because that's what he learned, how to study the other person. So when he gets to Laban, he realizes, you know what Laban wants? He wants me here, because ever since I arrived for 30 days, there's been blessing. And he's having more animals built. His stock portfolio has increased. He wants to keep me here, but he doesn't want to pay me a salary because he's a cheapskate. So he wants me because I give him a blessing, but he doesn't want to pay me. So Yaakov sees this. So what does he offer him? Himself. He says, look, don't pay me any wage. I'll just take Leah and Rachel for my wages. No big deal, right? He already had used this mirror technique with his father, because he sees with his own dad, Isaac, that what does Isaac want? Isaac wants Jacob, but he wants a Jacob that has the component of survivability. So he offers that to Isaac with the chicanery, so Isaac can then say, oh, exactly, you're exactly what I want. You're both. So uniquely, Dr. Jekyll subsumes Mr. Hyde. Usually it's the other way around. He takes the Esau components. He becomes both Israel and Jacob, marries both, and then gives us the lineage that we have. And why is this so critical? Because that's what the Jewish people have always been successful. If you think about it, we've always had this one little unique component. Every time we're sent and kicked out of one country and go somewhere else, again, that doesn't mean it's not subliminal, but the Jewish people always succeed. Why? Because we look at what our new oppressors want from us. Oh, well, they want someone to manage the banking system. So the Rothschild family invents the banking system. Thank you very much. We go to another country and we're needed in this area. The Jewish people see what the need is. We understand survival techniques because it comes from Jacob and the Yishuv Hashem and Aver. And we fill that role. Whatever role is open to us, whatever we can be a best use, the Jewish people have always had that amazing Jacob-infused genetics, that we're always able to see what does the con man want from us? Where can we be most useful? Now, again, don't get me wrong. Our use always runs out, and then they kick us out of the country, and we wind up somewhere else. But if you look historically, we always survived because we were useful to the government, to the king, to the sultan. And as long as our use was there, how do we know to fill that niche? Right here. So now we understand how Dr. Jekyll became Mr. Hyde. Thank you, everyone.